I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is MIT Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology, Sherry Turkle. She's joined in conversation by journalist Katie Hafner. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Sherry Turkle and Katie Hafner.
So as a community center, we are deeply invested in finding ways to bring people together. Sherry Turkle's work on inter and intrapersonal relationships is of special importance to us. For over 30 years, Sherry has studied how we interact with technology. A professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT, she's also a licensed clinical psychologist. She's also a sociologist, so and founder and director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. Dr. Turkle is the author of 5 books and 3 edited collections, including a trilogy of 3 landmark studies on our relationship with digital culture, The Second Self, Life on the Screen, and most recently, Alone Together. A recipient of a Guggenheim and Rockefeller Humanities Fellowship, she's a featured media commentator. Sherry is a recipient of a Harvard Centennial Medal and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Her latest book, Reclaiming Conversation, was released earlier this year to critical acclaim. Appearing in conversation with Dr. Turkle is Katie Hafner. For about a decade, Katie wrote about technology for the New York Times, and she now writes on healthcare for the paper. She is the author of 6 books, including most recently her memoir, Mother, Daughter, Me. Ladies and gentlemen, Sherry Turkle and Katie Hafner.
Okay, well, I know what, you know what I'm going to ask you to do. Three guesses and the first two don't count. So I would love it if we all took our cell phones and put them on silent. So we're going to make this a true conversation, and we also want to make it as interactive as possible. So I do have to say that whole thing about phones and what makes them so alluring, when Sherry wrote Alone Together, she was talking about phones and the ping that comes in when you get a text, and she called it, I think you called it, it's everyone's ray of hope. You called it, you said that people call their phones their place of hope. So in 1984, you published The Second Self, Computers and the Human Spirit, and that subtitle is so apt and wonderful and relevant today. Every time I read something that you've written, I think, oh boy, she did. Not only did she write this well, but she did it just in time. And so you have never stopped writing about the technology and its effect on the human spirit. In fact, so a review of The Second Self called that book the first true ethnographic study of the computer world. And for years I thought that was your first book, when in fact it was not. I figured out you had a whole other intellectual life before that, including a book that had absolutely nothing to do with computers. Your training is as a sociologist and clinical psychologist, and you wrote a book called Psychoanalytic Politics. And I've read, by the way, that The Second Self took 6 years for Sherry to research. And it came out in 1984, which means, if I'm doing the math right, you started the research in 1978, which was around the time the other book came out?
Yeah. I started the book in 1976.
In 1976. So how on earth did it occur to you so early to merge these two fields and look at the effects of computers on humans?
Well, it was really very simple. I'd finished a book on how psychoanalysis in France had gone from being an intellectual endeavor to something where there was a kind of infatuation with Freud in France. Everybody wanted to be psychoanalyzed. I mean, it's very hard to put yourself back into the state of mind. But how it kind of hit the street, how this set of ideas had hit the street. And I went to MIT because MIT wanted somebody who knew how to think about, let's say, artificial intelligence and how it might come into popular discourse. And that was the basis of my being hired at MIT, to do that kind of work. So I went to MIT, and really in my, I want to say my second day, I met young people who were playing with the first personal computers, the kind that you had to build and not buy, but the kind that you could take home and make your own.
Like the trash 80s?
Even before that, the ones
the
you
Heath
had.
Kits?
Yes, the kind, really the kind, I mean, and who were playing with the early, you know, the early machines that they, you know, that they were, that they, I mean, I called my book The Second Self, my first book on computers and people, because the first day that I met these people, it was clear that their feelings about those screens, those feelings about those computers they were working with, were not like stereos and cars. I mean, it wasn't just another technology. This was a mind technology where people really saw themselves in it, where they projected themselves and they almost saw this machine as an other. It was both themselves and an other, and it was a deeply psychological machine. It was an intimate machine. And I just pivoted. And I just said, you know, for a psychologist who's interested in how we see ourselves, how we think about ourselves, they used metaphors from the computer world to think about themselves. You know, don't interrupt me, I want to clear my buffer. You know, I mean, it was, even going beyond, you know, thinking about, you know, mind as program and stuff like that. And I just made a complete pivot, and I immersed myself in how, for example, kids who played with the first computer toys and games thought about whether they were alive, and if so, how so. And I mean, here was an object that was sort of on the boundary between what was alive and what wasn't alive.
And whether they had emotions.
And whether they had emotions, and if so, how so. And if they had emotions, how were people different than they were? And, I mean, there were a world of things about the psychological impact of having this new kind of object in the world that I just felt this is my calling. And so that's how I started in 1976.
And you were in just the right place for it, MIT.
I was exactly at the right place at the right time, but I hadn't come there to do that. And I think that's kind of a lesson to when I talk to students about, you know, there's a way to talk about my career. I went to MIT to study this. I really did not. I really did not go to MIT to study this. But I had a prepared mind.
So let's then fast forward to 1996 when you were on the cover. I don't know if anyone here remembers this. We are, of course, in the heart of the tech world here. You were on the cover of Wired.
Yes.
It was an 8,000-word profile written by Pam McCordick. And Sherry, I couldn't get an image. I wanted to try to get one that we could show. Sherry was sort of like purple aura around her head, and she was the
cyber diva.
And there was a lot of talk around then in the story about MUDs and the multi-user
dungeons
where people did a lot of interesting interacting online,
right.
And it was a hugely optimistic view of technology and humans.
Right.
And so you know what I'm going to ask you. So
What
happened? When did you grow more skeptical? Was there like one moment?
Well, basically, What I was interested in was how these how computer technology changes the way we think. That is my, and feel, and how we behave as humans. And my original take on this was I wanted psychologists and humanists and intellectual historians to get interested in this. And I could not wake them up to this story. I mean, I thought that I was right. I mean, computers profoundly change the way we think, our relationships, how we think of ourselves as humans, how we raise our kids. I mean, everything about our psychologies and our relationships. And I could not get my fellow psychologists.
Did they think you were, off the wall?
Off the wall. I mean, what's a nice girl like you who knows about French psychoanalysis doing in a place, in a thing like this? I mean, why don't you study English psychoanalysis next? Or, So what fascinated me in The Second Self, which was my first book, was the one-on-one of person with computer. And then I turned, as the technology shifted, and you could contact other people and go on to games where you could take on other identities in playing games, what was the psychological impact of going online and assuming different identities and playing with identity online in a kind of identity workshop that was the online world. And I thought that was, I don't want to say I was positive, because there were problems with it. People would get lost. They would think their online life was better than their life, the rest of their life. They used to call it the ROL, the rest of life. And, I thought that was a problem, and I talked about that. But this was fascinating, the idea of using the online world as an identity workshop. And so the intent of Life on the Screen was to say to psychologists, humanists, anthropologists, study this, attend to this.
Did they start listening?
Well, I think gradually, but I think that was a very hard sell. It was a very hard sell. And so my cyber diva phase was essentially which was brief, what was basically saying, not that this was great, but that this was really an important thing that was happening, and that people were using this in the most fascinating and interesting ways. And here's what happened next. At the end of writing Life on the Screen, which is this book that got me onto the cover of Wired magazine.
And a TED Talk. When back in the days,
yes,
when TED,
right,
was...
my first TED Talk.
Richard Saul Wurman.
Right, mm-hmm. My first TED Talk. I met two technologies right at the end. And I sort of mentioned them in the book right at the end. And I don't say much about them, except to sort of put them in. And the first technology was a robot named Cog. That was a new kind of robot. It was a sociable robot. It was a robot that engaged you, not because it was smart, but because it pretended that it cared about you. It looked you in the eye. It mirrored your gestures. It made you think that it recognized you and cared about you. And I saw people relate to this robot as though they had met essentially another human being. And I saw the power of this new kind of object. And I saw that I saw how vulnerable we were to this new kind of object. And I just kind of wanted to follow that story because I saw my colleagues gearing up to create robot best friends, robot lovers, robot companions, robot, which if you're following the story, you know that has just taken off. Mm-hmm. And the second technology I met that upset me was people were starting to wear computers on their bodies so they could be on the web 24/7 all the time, essentially carry the web with them and always be communicating, always be on the web, always be whenever they wanted to be, always on new technology. And at the time, to do this, you had to have like antenna. It was, and you had to be wearing a backpack with your computer, and you had to be, you looked as though you were disabled. It was an amazing, they called themselves cyborgs, the people who did these studies. But I could see, the moment I saw them, that this was going to be miniaturized, and it would end up that we would all be cyborgs in that sense, and it's ended up that we have all of that, every one of us who's carrying a phone. And that quality of, you didn't have to say, okay, well, after our chat, I'll go and I'll do something on my computer and I'll have my identity experimentation and then I'll come back and we'll chat some more. But that at any moment, I could just go like this to you and go to my phone and interrupt the relationship I was in to be elsewhere. I could see that that was going to be something to which we were incredibly vulnerable, this idea that we could always be elsewhere, and that was going to cause us trouble. And I met both of those technologies as I was finishing the Cyber Diva book, and those are the technologies that I tracked in my next work, Alone Together.
Alone Together, and then...
Yeah. That was my progression.
I have to say, Sherry, I think you've outdone yourself. This is, it's really, really
I love
good.
This book, I should say.
She loves this book.
I love it. I never have said this about any of my other books. I'm always like, oh, this is so interesting. My
I can attest to that,
I really love
She's
this
like,
book.
Oh, is it any good?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really something. It's a tour de force because it's a coming together of so many aspects of sort of, I have to say that one thing I like about growing older is just this sort of treasure chest of stuff that I now know. And you've drawn on so much of it and given us this wonderful work. I love in particular the structure. So the way she's structured it is with these chairs. The book is actually divided into these sections, and it borrows from Henry David Thoreau's idea of chairs, one chair for solitude, two chairs for friendship, and three chairs for society. And Sherry then throws in a fourth chair that Thoreau could never have known about. And then they ended up, the two chairs ended up on the cover, which you're very happy with, right?
Very happy.
Authors aren't usually all that happy with their books, but their covers, but you were happy with this?
Very happy with the cover.
I don't know. I might have gone for armchairs, but whatever. So tell us about the chairs.
Well, Thoreau inspires me. I mean, the quote from Thoreau is, I had three chairs in my cabin, one for solitude, two for friendship, and three for society. And the reason I love that quote is people think of Thoreau as a recluse, as somebody who got away from it all, and actually his friends joke that he could hear Emerson's dinner bell from his cabin because he went to dinner at Emerson's house as often as he could. He loved conversation, he loved friendship, but what I love about Thoreau and the reason that I used him to structure the arc of the book is that his work makes the essential point. This is the professor in me. It's like saying, if you walk out of here thinking, knowing or learning one thing or remembering one thing, remember this one thing, which is the relationship between solitude and friendship, between solitude and being able to be in a successful relationship. Which is that we need to be able to be alone in solitude and know who we are in order to come to a relationship with another person, and first of all, have something to offer that's authentic, that's ours, but also to be able to hear that person and really hear what they have to say and not just project onto them what we need them to be saying in order to kind of shore up our fragile sense of self.
You're listening to MIT Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology, Sherry Turkle, whose book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. She's joined in conversation by Katie Hafner on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So that solitude and a capacity for relationship feeding back onto our own self-reflection is a kind of virtuous circle that Thoreau understood when he talked about those three chairs. And if you have friendship and if you have self-reflection, those are the bases for you to bring to the social world. You know, the kind of foundation for really making your society better. And I have one chapter on the social world and on politics, which draws from a phrase of Thoreau called the nick of time. And he talked about fully inhabiting your nick of time, your moment. And that to me has always had a, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, that to me, that notion of living fully in your moment with a capacity for solitude, bringing that to a capacity for relationship, and then bringing that to really make your mark. I mean, he even talks about etching it into his walking stick, his nick of time. I mean, to me, this completely captured what conversation is about. That all of these are the virtuous circle of conversation, that in our conversations with ourselves and self-reflection, we learn what we need to learn to have conversations with others and with the social world. So those are the chairs, and I, you know, that it begins with this.
Enter the cell phone. How's it going out there, by the way, with not looking at your phones? Good. We left ours in the green room, I know, and we've got the shakes here. One of the things that I find most troubling, even just wrenching in this book, is the family battles over the cell phone at the dinner table, just during what could be otherwise time when a father, there's one amazing story of a father who had older children, and when he bathed them, he would tell them stories and he was fully present, and now he has a toddler who he can't do that for because he's just so drawn to the phone.
He just puts the toilet seat down, sits on, and does his email.
And Sherry has so many voices. You know, part of your research is just going out and talking to people, which is great. And troubling, and one of the people you talk to is a man named John, who goes on a field. He's in his 30s. He goes on a field trip with his 7-year-old daughter, and he went on the field trip. I'm going to just give you a little backstory on this, with the intention to spend the day with his daughter, but his phone stood in the way. I've never heard it phrased that way. He admits that his phone also stands in the way of talking to Simone when they're at home. So, Sherry, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading about the tug of war between John and his daughter over the phone.
I'm moved by John's assessment of himself as a father. I don't think I'm so bad with her, but I'm somewhat bad with her. John knows his behavior upsets Simone, and it leads him to a negative view of himself as a parent. He justifies himself weakly by saying that, quote, among my friends, everyone does it. Here's how John describes Simone's objections when he plants her in front of a television cartoon so that he can go to his phone. As on the bus, because part of the backstory is they had gone on a field trip together. He wanted to be closer to her, and so he took her on a school field trip. He volunteered. But the whole field trip, he spends using his phone to take pictures of her and the trip and posting them.
And not talking to her.
And not talking to her. Until she tugs him and says, Daddy, you're not saying anything to me. And he has this kind of moment of recognition that things are very, very bad. So as on the bus, where she objected, which is a big theme in the book, kids objecting to their parents' behavior, she puts up with it for a while. This is watching her television program. And then objects. And then he says, he describes the objection. Simone will tell you to put your phone away and stuff. And then you get sad. This is John talking. You're like, God, I've been on my phone a lot. You know, I think kids are probably suffering a lot. John isn't the only parent to tell me that knowing their children's unhappiness is not enough to make them put down their phones. There is a flight from parenting and mentorship. It has to be addressed.
And, you know, I went into this book thinking that it was going to be the parents complaining about the kids on the phones. And it was the opposite. And you feel in the book when you're reading it that there's this despair among the kids, and that the kids do it, and it gets into this vicious circle. The kids do it because the parents do it. But most poignantly, it's when the parents know that the quality of their parenting is suffering, but they can't seem to fix it.
Right.
And anyway, we'll get into that later when we get to the optimistic Sherry, because she's not. It's like not a Debbie Downer. I mean, you really, really you're a champion of technology. I know that. I know that. And we'll get to that. But as long as we're on the downer stuff, let's talk about the decline in empathy levels that you discuss in the book. And this is just fascinating stuff.
Well, recent research shows that in the past 20 years, there's been a 40% decline in all the ways we know how to measure empathy among college students, with most of the decline taking place in the past 10 years, which researchers attribute to devices. And, you know, I should say that empathy is very simply the ability for me to put myself in Katie's frame of mind and sort of guess or intuit from her body language, from just all the signals she's putting out, from her situation, what she's thinking and feeling, so that I can better, you know, connect with her and her ability to do the same for me.
Someone put it, I'm sorry to interrupt, but someone put it really well when they said that when you speak to people in person, you're forced to recognize their full human reality. You're absolutely forced to do it, which then brings about some level of...
So, conversation is the empathy generator because it's practice. I mean, it's a very simple conversation is the empathy generator because it just gives us practice in doing that. Now, some of us are more empathic than others, but the way we develop this is through conversation and the youngest children. And empathy is in trouble. That college survey is not, the only indicator that we have about the trouble. I've been called in to one of the case studies I use in the book is a school called Holbrook, where I was called in to study really to consult to the school, because the teachers were so concerned. The way they put it was the 12-year-olds play on the playground like 8-year-olds, that they can't seem to put themselves in the place of the other children.
And how does that translate into real life? I mean, what were they doing on the playground?
Well, a child would exclude another child from a school event, and the director would call the children in and say, "What are you thinking?" Or say a cruelty, you know, and it's not new for children to be mean, but usually you call in a kid and you say, "You're mean. What we, you know, let's talk about." And these children, like, were blank. The teachers called them robotic about what they had done. And the teachers were frightened because this was not a school for children with developmental arrest or children who were on the autism spectrum. Or this was a fancy, competitive private school where kids did not seem to be able to put themselves in the place of the other kids. And the kids were having trouble talking to each other in class, relating to each other. In the dining room, they were talking about what was on their phones rather than talking to each other.
And then after that, you went to visit a device-free camp.
Yes. And then what studies show, too, that, and this is the optimistic part of the story, and why really I think that, you know, I mean, Katie flatters me by saying I'm writing my books just in time. I feel that this book, I was compelled to write this book. I mean, part of why I'm going to say I love this book, I mean, I was compelled to write this book because I think it's urgent. We can turn this around because, you know, to the failing conversations of our digital world, conversation, I say, is the talking cure. At a device-free camp, a place where you cannot bring your phone, in 5 days, these empathy levels go back up. In 5 days. And how do they go back up? What happens? Children talk to each other. Conversation is, in this sense, I mean, to make this pun, I mean, is the talking cure. So it's not a, it's very interesting. I just want to say parenthetically, the woman, the very brilliant psychologist, Sarah Conrath, who did the study of the 40% decline in empathy among college students, after she did that study, she was very depressed. I mean, that's an amazing thing. And what she's doing is writing empathy apps for the iPhone.
Oh, my God.
And this is a very hot discussion in my field.
You mean whether they should even be apps or...
Well, technology has gotten us into some trouble. And what is the role of technology in maybe getting us out of this trouble? And you can tell, just a few days ago, I spent some time with her talking about this. And you can tell that from my point of view, we are the empathy app. We are the empathy app. And yet there are many who think that we need to invent an empathy app. And this is a hot and debatable topic. But from my point of view, we should not be distracted by trying to invent something to put on our iPhones to give our kids another screen to look at. I mean, already we have baby bouncers with a slot for an iPad. We have potty trainers. And I told this story earlier in the day, and someone heard me tell the story, and they thought I was joking or making up these examples, but I'm not. You know, there are potty trainers with a slot for an iPad.
The baby's slot?
A baby's, yeah.
For the babies?
For the
phone?
No, in front of the baby. That while you sit in your baby bouncer.
Whose phone is it?
No, it's a baby bouncer.
Yeah.
And there's a slot in the baby bouncer to put in an iPad. So while the baby is in the bouncer, he or she is looking at the iPad. A potty trainer, that while the baby is on the potty trainer, he's looking at a screen, a tablet. There are And, you know, there's a whole world of apps for under 2 years old. And to give children another app to teach them empathy, there are now robots.
So they could get the empathy app on the iPad.
Yeah.
On the potty trainer.
Yes.
Okay. Just check it.
Just check it. Right. So to give, you know, so, I mean, to, and then, and now, I think very controversially, there are robots that are being designed not only to be a child's best friend, which, you know, I hope Kate is going to ask me about this, but just...
Ask you about what?
The robot best friend.
Oh, the robot best
the
friend.
The Hello Barbie stuff.
Remind me to ask you about that.
Right. I mean, there, it's like, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play is my basic... I really, this is, to me, this is a big problem. But
wait, just to be a little bit of a counterpoint there, yeah. I remember growing up and there was Chatty Cathy. How is that any different?
Because Chatty Cathy was a transparently know-nothing doll. This doll comes out.
Like an airhead doll?
It knew nothing. And you could tell, because I've done this experiment. Kids who had Chatty Cathy, and I'm sure...
I just remember the string would come out and then it wouldn't go back in.
Right. Right. It was obviously a mechanical doll and you knew the things it would say. And no,
but did we really know? I mean,
you
don't...
You really knew.
Okay. I really knew.
You really knew. You really knew that Chatty Cathy did not know too much about you. Hello Barbie is programmed to know whether you have siblings. So it comes out of the box like, so I have a sister. I hear you have a sister. I hate my sister. I'm jealous of my sister. Talk to me about whether you're jealous about your sister.
Wait, how does it know I have a sister?
It's been programmed.
Oh, I see.
So the whole idea is that it... and I know you have a sister. So it's programmed to give you this pretend empathy. And you cannot learn empathy. There is no such thing as pretend. You cannot. Empathy is something that comes from understanding the arc of a human life. Envy, sibling rivalry, comes from knowing what a mother is and what it is to be jealous of someone else because of a relationship with a mother. A doll does not have that to offer. And giving children pretend empathy is not the same. And
wait,
it's much healthier.
You call it, in fact, toxic.
It's toxic. Giving children a doll where they can that knows nothing, the age-old, you know, clothespin doll is healthy because a child can project what they're thinking and feeling onto this object. My favorite example is a girl who's just, you know, broken her mother's crystal, takes her Barbie or her row of Barbies and puts them in detention because, you know, she feels she should be punished. And in the course of doing that, kind of works through her feelings of, you know, guilt and working that through. But here's this doll that comes out with an agenda and a mind of her own. And and we're giving these objects, these fake empathic objects, not just to children, but we're giving them to the elderly. I've done many studies of these fake empathic objects in the elderly with the idea that this is good for the elderly because they'll have somebody to talk to. And remember this, that in all this fuss about giving objects to the elderly, all of the talk, or children, all of the conversation is about whether you can get a child or an older person to talk to this doll, to talk to this robot. And the question that I want to ask is, who's listening? Why aren't we thinking about who is listening to our children? Who is listening to the elder person who has this doll? Because empathy isn't just, are you talking? It's who's listening.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the human compact we have between generations. So what are we accomplishing by giving something to a child where we know that no one is listening to this child? What are we communicating to this child? We're saying we have nobody to listen to you who's really listening. Or to an older person to say, we have nobody here who can really listen to you. I mean, that's what I mean. Like, you know, this is not the direction. We talk about my skepticism. Is that when I'm very pro-technology, but let me put it differently. I'm not anti-technology, but I'm pro-conversation. And these technologies are not pro-conversation. These are not technologies that are supporting conversation.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of
other... Why didn't anybody applaud? That really is my creed.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features MIT professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology, Sherry Turkle, whose book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. She's joined in conversation by Katie Hafner. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So some of the more interesting parts of the book are about politics. They touch on political issues. And so I'd like you to tell me about Lana.
Well, in Thoreau's arc, you get from solitude, friendship, to society. And by the time you get to society, computers and the conversations that we are having and not having with computers, given our current digital environment, have a lot to do with politics and society. And I interviewed a lot of people about those conversations. And I was very struck by one young woman who said to me, and I give everybody a false name and put them in a false place, and her false name is Lana. But what was true was that she was a very brilliant woman, and she had just graduated from an Ivy League school with a degree in economics and just was smart as anything. And she said to me, and I interviewed her at a time, the book is American, the examples are American, I decided to do a book really about, what I knew of in this country. Things were really not good in America at the time I interviewed her. Politically, things were rough. People were being killed. There was mayhem. There was racism. There were police brutality of the most terrible sorts. Environmentally, things were terrible. And she said, "I'm glad I don't have any controversial opinions, because if I had any controversial opinions, I'd have to discuss them online, and there's no privacy online, and that wouldn't be a good thing." And I was so struck by this comment, because of course we have created a world online where people feel there is no privacy, there's no place to develop an idea in any private space, and basically I saw in her comment how a silencing of opinion starts because this woman was happy she didn't have, at this moment in American history, she was happy she didn't have any controversial opinions because she felt she had no place to discuss them. And I thought it was the most, we had created the most, what's the opposite of a virtuous circle? A vicious circle. We had created the most vicious circle of silencing of opinion. You know, she started me really on an odyssey of exploring the whole question of mind space in the computational environment and the digital environment in which we lived. And in the book, I compare her situation to mine growing up in Brooklyn in the 1950s and early 60s, where my grandmother, and Katie and I were talking about this before the presentation, my grandmother took me to the library once or twice a week and saved until I was 10 years old, taking me to the big library up in Brooklyn, Grand Army Plaza, which is this really impressive library. And before she took me to Grand Army Plaza, she sat me down and she said, "Now you're ready, you're old enough to understand that we're going to the big library now that has every book, pretty much. And the books you take out from the library are a secret between you and the library." Mm-hmm. And this was the height of, you know, the McCarthy era. I mean, you know, she knew, you know, she said, "You could take out the Communist Manifesto. Nobody would know." In other words, you can read anything. Nobody ever has the right to know, and that is what is great about this country. And she sort of saved this information until she thought I was old enough to understand. I was about 10. The basis of her patriotism, she was somebody from an Eastern European, you know, who had experienced the terror, you know, the, you know, who, for whom the Second World War and what it was to live in a fascist environment and what, you know, what a totalitarian world was like was very much on her mind. And here was a country where mind space, I mean, she didn't use that word, it's the word that I think of, this was to her the miracle of this country. And when I met Lana and all the other people I interviewed who were like her, because I was starting to say that, you know, and when you do qualitative research, you don't report the story unless you have a very deep bench of a lot of people who are basically saying the same thing, or else it doesn't ring true and people say, "Oh, that's a kind of one-off story, that doesn't sound like right." I mean, many young people have this feeling about it's better to not have a thought because if you're going to put it online, it's going to be trouble. And that's the only place to express yourself. So the questions I ask in Reclaiming Conversation are, to reclaim conversation, we need to ask ourselves, what is intimacy without privacy and what is democracy without privacy? And I think these are, my optimism comes from, I think these are questions that are coming up for us now that we haven't wanted to think about, but that are coming up for us now. And I think these are going to be the big questions for the next decade.
So Jonathan Franzen reviewed the book in the New York Times, and he said that Reclaiming Conversation is best appreciated as a sophisticated self-help book. And I'm guessing that you took that as a compliment. Oops.
That Jonathan Franzen reviewed my book put me into a state of mind where everything he said was a compliment. The idea of, I was reading Purity at the same time that apparently he was reading my book. And, you know, I would say that there's nothing that Jonathan Franzen said about my book, including the part that he didn't like, that I didn't just say, "Oh, yeah."
Okay, but the self, but the self-help part, I'm really actually trying to get to some substance here, which is, like, what do we do?
Yes,
what's the prescription?
This book is so unlike me. I mean, it's so unlike other things that I've written. Because in this book, it really is a call to action. I mean, I say that Alone Together was a description of a problem, and this book is my call to action. And I really do give you tips. For those of you who buy the book, I am not afraid to give you tips. And it turns out that after 30, 40 years of studying this, I have so many tips. I shocked myself at how many. I clearly was suppressing all of my tips all of these years.
Did it just feel like it was you were slumming it by?
No, it felt like Sherry Turkle unplugged. It felt more like I turn out to have all of these tips.
You have great tips.
I have great tips. I have things to do if you're in business. If any of you are in business, I have things to do of how to set up your office. If you're in medicine, I have things to do.
You mean technology-wise?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What to do with... If you're a parent, I have tips. I have tips in every chapter. I have tips. I think that this is... I don't feel that this diminishes me as an academic at all. I mean, I just turn
like
out...
Like real stuff.
I just turn out to have, after all of this studying, I have opinions, and I make it clear that these are my opinions, but I've given you so much research before that when you come to my opinions, it's not like you say, well, how did she ever get there? You know, I mean, so if are you going to ask me some tips?
Well, one tip that Franson mentioned was the most important thing you can do is make the dinner table and the car sacred spaces for reclaiming conversation.
Yes. But the car is the key. The car is the key. I mean, the dinner table is an obvious one, but the car is the key. Because they are putting putting movie projectors in the back seat of your van. This is a big mistake. You know, you are not texting. I mean, it's funny, I was going to cross my mind. Whenever I tell this story, when I keep saying, you know, you shouldn't be texting in your car, and I sort of want to cross myself, but I'm Jewish. I mean, so I can't, like, you know, sort of, you know, don't text in your car. So you're not texting if you're driving. Nobody else, so nobody else should be texting either. This is not a chance for anybody to be catching up on their social media feed. This is not the place. If you have kids, this is where those long silences should happen, where finally they say something to you. This is the place for those horrible games that people remember all their life. So the car is ground zero for reclaiming conversation, the dinner table, the dining room, and particularly the kitchen, because one thing that has happened, and I'm very sympathetic to this, because I'm very sympathetic to this generation of children. When they say, I don't know what to talk about, I don't know what to do, I have nothing to... They really mean it. Their imaginations have been stifled. They don't know how to tolerate a moment of boredom. They've been given a screen. Whenever they've had a moment of boredom, they've had a screen to go to. So the nice thing about the kitchen is that when they have that lull, when they have that moment of lull where they don't know what to do, you say, chop. You can give them something to do in the kitchen. So actually, the kitchen and cooking and doing things together is very important. And, you know, ultimately... The people who love us and the people we love, I think, are going to be responsive, not to not to the anger, but to I want to have, and our children, I want to have a conversation with you, I want to hear you, I want to know you. Ultimately, that's the message that I think is going to turn this around. You know, we have to find a way to say, we're in the car together, I need to talk to you because I need to, in our family, I need to talk to you, I need to understand you. Make empathy, I mean, I spoke to so many children who had never walked to the corner store with a parent who hadn't been on their phone. You know, I think so many of us have not gotten the memo that the people in our lives actually want to hear us. So reclaim.
Reclaim. So I'd like to have you end by reading the very end of the book, but I want to introduce this idea, one thing that came out of this 8,000-word profile of Sherry in 1996 in Wired by Pam McCordick was this idea of liminal moments. And I'm going to read from it. And this is a quote from Sherry. I'm drawn to, I love the liminal moment, she says. I first heard that phrase from the anthropologist Victor Turner when I was his student at the University of Chicago. It means a moment when things are betwixt and between, when old structures have broken down and new ones have not yet been created. Historically, these times of change are the times of greatest cultural creativity. Everything is infused with new meanings. She leans forward, this is McCordick writing about Sherry, disclosing something close to her heart. If your culture is going through a liminal moment, don't hide it, she begins. Celebrate it, understand it for what it is. Rejoice in the liminal moment. So why don't you read just the very end of the book, this last paragraph.
Okay. So this is how I end the book, and actually I discussed this. This is our nick of time and our line to toe. So this is Thoreau's phrase, our nick of time. This is our nick of time and our line to toe to acknowledge the unintended consequences of technologies to which we are vulnerable, to respect the resilience that has always been ours. We have time to make the corrections and remember who we are, creatures of history, of deep psychology, of complex relationships, of conversations artless, risky, and face-to-face.
Sherry, thank you so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was MIT Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology, Sherry Turkle, whose book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. She was joined in conversation by Katie Hafner. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.